to the Gila Members Community Radio show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts generally alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise. Today, though, we have a special show with all three of the hosts here, and we'll be discussing our issues and accomplishments for 2012 and looking ahead to the new year. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, or UGWA as we're known. We're a watershed protection nonprofit group that's been around for almost 20 years. We work to protect the Gila River and its tributaries and the Gila National Forest through advocacy and by doing restoration projects. UGWA is also one of the three groups that comprise the Gila Conservation Coalition, or GCC. There's a lot of acronyms here. So I want to introduce my other two co-hosts of the show. We're not usually all together here, so this is a treat for us. So I'd like to welcome Allison Civic to the show. Hi, Allison.
Good morning, Donna.
And Kim McCreary from New Mexico Wilderness Alliance.
Hi, Donna. Hi, Allison.
Hello.
Okay, so we have a number of topics that we want to talk about today, some of the things that our groups have done separately in 2012. We also work together on a lot of issues where we kind of overlap. And today we're going to try and focus on some of the issues that we work on separately. So I think I'll start with Allison, who's the director of Gila Resources Information Project, and she can talk to you about some of the mining issues that have happened this year.
Thanks, Donna. Let me just remind people who GRIP is. We were founded in 1998, and we're a nonprofit environmental organization that works to promote community health by protecting our environment and natural resources here in southwest New Mexico. And we also are a partner in the Gila Conservation Coalition, along with Donna's organization, UGWA, the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and the Center for Biological Diversity. So we'll talk at some point, I think, over the course of our end-of-year show on the efforts that GCC is talking about. But I'd like to start out by just talking a bit about GRIP's accomplishments here in 2012. We had a show early on in Earth Matters' short history on the water quality regulation for the copper mining industry. And as folks probably recall, if you listened to that show, that this is actually a regulation that the mining industry wanted back in 2009. The mining industry and the dairy industry requested that the state legislature pass a bill that would help to streamline the water quality regulations that impact the mining industry and the dairy industry. Well, the New Mexico Environment Department worked with the dairy industry and stakeholders. They got that rule done. And then in January of this year, GRIP and the New Mexico Environmental Law Center and Amigos Bravos attended monthly, sometimes more often, meetings with technical consultants and policy folks to draft a water quality regulation for copper mines. And really the intent here was to streamline the regulatory process for the mines. I mean, what's happened over the years is that permits get written and developed in a very site-specific context, and there's a lot of battling back and forth. And so industry said, listen, we want more certainty. We want to know what are the industry best management practices that we're going to be subject to. And so that was the intent of this regulation. We had a draft that was developed by all of the parties, all of the stakeholders, and was actually a fairly reasonable draft. The environmental community, there were things we didn't like, but, you know, for the most part, it was fairly reasonable. And as many folks probably recall, the draft that was actually put out for public comment differed greatly from what everybody had put together and really reflected a pro-industry regulation. And we were very disappointed with that, and we had public meeting here in Silver City. Lots of folks came out for that. So essentially what this comes down to is the water quality rule for the copper mining industry will allow pollution as opposed to preventing pollution, which is the intent of the state's Water Quality Act. So it's completely inconsistent with how New Mexico regulates water quality. And so we're very concerned about that. And the hearing before the Water Quality Control Commission has been postponed from January of 2013 till April 9th. So what?
Why are they postponing that?
Just to give all the parties more time to prepare briefs and stuff, because it's going to be a lot of legal material that will have to be submitted to the Water Quality Control Commission. And I should also mention that the Attorney General also submitted comments on the draft rule and agreed with the environmental community that this proposed rule for the copper mining industry is inconsistent with the Water Quality Act. So the Attorney General is on the same side with the environmental community.
Allison, I wanted to ask, you said that the draft that came out was substantially different than what you guys had come up with in your collaborative effort. I wonder if you could tell us what some of those differences are.
Sure. So two key differences. One is, and these are kind of difficult to explain, so I'm going to try and make it simple, but essentially what the copper mining industry inserted in the rule, just a few key phrases that are extremely significant in how we regulate water quality. Water quality standards must be met at, what they added, designated monitors. Okay, so what that means is something that's called point of compliance, which other states in this country have, but that's not how we regulate water quality in New Mexico. We regulate water quality by saying that all water that's currently being used or could be used in the future is protected under the Water Quality Act. Okay, so we don't say, oh, water just at this groundwater monitor must meet standards. No, it's any water for present or reasonably foreseeable future use. And so what, by inserting these little phrases into the rule, all of a sudden it significantly changed how we regulate groundwater quality in the state. Now, that's making policy, right, through making law through a rule, as opposed to going back to the Water Quality Act and the legislature and all that and changing how we regulate water, groundwater quality. So it's a huge shift. So that means we could be meeting standards at this designated monitor here, but at this monitor over here, even if it's exceeding standards, it's not a designated monitor, so we wouldn't have to meet standards at this monitor over here. So that's really huge. And obviously at mine sites, and given the hydrology that we have at our mine sites here with fracturing, and it's super complicated. And so, you know, we're very concerned that this shift in how groundwater is regulated could have, you know, big implications.
So just inserting this little phrase that seems kind of innocuous has really had big changes. Like, oh, yeah, you can pollute over here, but not over there.
Right.
And yeah, that sounds pretty bad.
And so, you know, this will be a big issue before the Water Quality Control Commission next year. And, you know, basically, we've already fought this battle in the Tyrone appeal, GRIP appeal, the Tyrone closure closeout permit. We had, you know, 3 weeks of hearing before the Water Quality Control Commission a number of years ago, in which the current way that the state regulates groundwater quality was upheld, and point of compliance was not supported. So, you know, we've been here already, and here we are going back to this issue again. So just, you know, it'll be more time in the courts.
So what other changes have been proposed? that came out in this draft?
So, as you recall, the whole purpose for this regulation was to streamline how we're permitting these mines, and the mines wanted certainty. They wanted to know, okay, let's designate industry best management practices for, you know, so they know, okay, we have to put liners under stockpiles, leach stockpiles. Well, that was in there, and now with the changes that have been made by industry, that's a more discretionary thing that could be done. But it's not mandatory. And that was that's what industry does. That's an industry best management practice. That's something that will significantly protect groundwater quality at our mines. That's what other, you know, that's what other mines are doing. But it costs money to do that. And so now that's a change to what, you know, all of the parties had talked about in the stakeholder, the Copper Rule Advisory Committee, that in our opinion is not at all consistent with industry best management practices. So
you know, what I find interesting about that is you have industry, it could cost them a bit of money to line these pits. On the other hand, you're going to have economic costs associated with health problems for people down the road. So you know, it's as if they want to protect their bottom line, but they're not thinking about the community and the future of the community at large.
Absolutely, Kim. I mean, what this amounts to is giving the industry a right to pollute and transfer the cost of cleanup from the polluter to us, the public. The public
and
sector,
healthcare.
The taxpayer, and the right. I mean, because if we were ever to use any of this water, and this obviously is well into the future, but you know, if any of this water in our regional aquifer, if it were to be contaminated, and we wanted to use it or needed to use it in the future for water supply, we would have to bear the cost of that cleanup before it could be used. So, you know, that's a real concern. I mean, the Water Quality Act is there to ensure that our groundwater supplies are protected and that the polluter pays, essentially. And so this rule amounts to allowing the polluter to pollute, and it will amount to exactly what you say, economic costs imposed on the public. So,
you brought up before the issue of the Attorney General submitting comments on this draft. Can you say what their position was?
Yeah, so similar to our position, they submitted 98 pages of comments that basically summarized from the Tyrone Appeal back, you know, a number of years ago, all the points, all the reasons why this new proposed rule is inconsistent with the Water Quality Act. And the major issue being, you know, this idea of point of compliance, that's one issue. Also, the fact that the mine site would be allowed to pollute within the surface, what they call like the surface drainage area. So it's kind of complicated to describe, but if all of the water, groundwater is flowing into the pit, they're going to pump and treat that water. As long as they're capturing this contamination, they're allowed to pollute within this open pit capture zone area.
Mm. Okay.
Drainage, surface drainage area. So they're allowed to pollute as long as they're sort of capturing this pollution. So if they're going to put a leach, they're going to leach inside this pit, it's okay. They don't need to put a liner. All these other things that they wouldn't have to do to prevent pollution. So that's the other kind of big issue.
So, Allison, what I was wondering then is what can folks do? All right, how can they have their voices heard?
Yeah, well, we certainly appreciate all the folks that came out for that public meeting in October and submitted comments as part of the public comment period. There's going to be opportunity for that come April as well as part of the Water Quality Control Commission hearing. So again, if people want to come to that hearing, we've been told it's probably going to be another 2 or 3 weeks of hearing. So we can keep people clued in to when the best times are to make public comment. But and people can either do that in person, orally, or submit public comment in writing. So they should check out our GRIP website or sign up for our email alert at www.healaresources.info.
Very good. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back talking about more mining cleanup issues. We're back to Earth Matters, the show that brings you information about environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, and if you're just joining us, I'm here today with my co-producers and co-hosts Allison Civic and Kim McCreary. Allison, I wonder if you could tell us what other issues GRIP is working on besides the copper regulations.
Yeah, well, obviously we're watchdogging all the permitting issues that are happening at Grant County Mines, and we're also watchdogging and overseeing the permitting process for a new mine over in Hillsboro called the Copper Flat Mine. But the one thing I want to really emphasize that GRIP is really excited about is the cleanup of the San Vicente tailings pile. That's that big orangey-yellow pile that's on the west side of the San Vicente Creek that has actually sat there since the 1940s when people wanted to process the metals in that pile for use in the Second World War. But that pile's been compromised by a series of high rain events over the years that have washed the tailings into San Vicente Creek and basically transported contamination from the pile into the creek, contaminating groundwater and at times surface water. And through an agreement, or through a settlement, I should say, between Freeport-McMoRan and the State Office of the Natural Resources Trustee, there was a $13 million settlement for Freeport's liability or damages that they caused to groundwater at their three mines here in Grant County. That was settled back the end of 2010, and the ONRT created a restoration plan, and the cleanup of the San Vicente tailings was number one priority in that restoration plan, and GRIP worked hard with community partners like Grant County Trails Group and Town of Silver City to really make sure that the San Vicente tailings cleanup was number one on that list, because really there was no other mechanism by which to clean up that pile, or just no other funds available. There's no potentially responsible party. You know, that pile had been there since the 40s, so there's no company or person liable for cleanup of that site. So cleanup should begin in early 2013, and we're really excited about that. And the other good news is that Freeport-McMoRan is going to accept that material and really cut down on the transportation and disposal costs. And so we'll save, you know, at least $1 million for cleanup of that site, and that $1 million could be used for other groundwater restoration projects here in Silver City in the mining district. So it is yet to be determined actually what projects will get funded, but now we have an additional $1 million to help with protecting and restoring our groundwater quality.
That's great news. I'm glad that the taxpayer won't be stuck having to pay for all of that since the company is long gone. So I want to turn now to Kim McCreary of New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and ask you, Kim, what's going on in 2013 with your group?
First, I would like to let our listeners know what NM Wild's mission is, and that's to protect and restore wild places in New Mexico. And we've been very much involved in the Mexican wolf recovery efforts in terms of advocating for their recovery. And to that end, through the organizing and mobilizing we did in 2012, we actually had 1,000 members contacting their public officials calling for much-needed changes in wolf management policy and practice. And specifically, We are calling for more releases now because there are genetic problems with the population, which numbers estimate around 58. We need to get some new genes out there to make the population more robust. In addition to that, guys need to find gals and gals need to find guys. There's wolves out there on the landscape and they can't find a mate, and it's a bit difficult. So that's something else that we've been calling for. Also, there is a rule that says captive bred Mexican wolves can only be released in Arizona in the primary recovery area. That needs to be changed. We need to have captive bred wolves released into New Mexico. What happens is, because wolves are territorial, just like people have homes that they protect, wolves have territories that they protect, and so the habitat becomes saturated. So it limits the number of animals that can be put out there. So again, we need more releases now, we need releases of wolves into our state. And we have had a tremendous response from the public supporting this, but this needs to continue if we're going to pressure our public officials and Fish and Wildlife Service sufficiently, okay, to bring these changes about. We launched the Mexican Wolf Watch, and that's kind of a special group of folks that pledged to continue taking action whenever a call goes out to help save this critically endangered subspecies. And as I just said, that continued pressure is really critical. So if you'd like to join that special group, you can send me an email at kim@nmwild.org. We will be, of course, sending our alerts out to everyone, but this is kind of like the insider group that's going to put the heavy-duty pressure on officials, and we really do need that.
So, Kim, the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance has really done a tremendous job of combining art and science, and I know you had a couple of events in 2012 that I thought were really terrific. Maybe you can tell people about them.
Gee, thanks, Allison. Appreciate that. We had one really cool event where we sponsored an artisan residency for the International Symposium on Electronic Art. And I just want to say thank you to Michael Berman again for organizing that. He just did a fantastic job. The person that came out was Marina Zirkow, and her work has been exhibited internationally, and she is a Guggenheim Fellow as well. And Marina spent, two and a half weeks here and kind of went through a crash course. I mean, Michael Berman certainly took her out in the wonderful wild Gila and showed her many things, discussed many things. I had the privilege of hanging out with Marina and doing a lot of other things, too, out there in the field. And she took all of her conversations with a broad group of people. She tried to talk to ranchers, and I'm not sure if that actually happened, but store owners, people in Catron County, people in Grant County, and this influenced the work that they eventually produced. And when I say they, she then took on a collaborator, Christy Lease, and they created this really incredible suite of artwork about Mexican wolves, cattle, and people. And I think the real what really got me about it is the fact that the work that they've done evokes a lot of laughter and thought, and depolarizes what I consider an all too heated debate sometimes. So that was really a fun thing to do. And in addition to that, we also presented Wild Harmonies, and this was up at the Lenzig Theater in Santa Fe. And this was a solo concert by internationally renowned pianist Alain Gramont. And all the proceeds went for wolf recovery projects. There were 600 people in the audience. I was one of those people. And I have to tell you that it was, I can't even put into words how I felt. I mean, her performance was just absolutely incredible and so moving. I mean, in the end, there were actually 600 people up on their feet howling thank you, because it was such a remarkable performance by such a remarkable pianist.
That sounds great. I wish I had been able to see that. So stay with us. We'll be right back for more of Earth Matters. Back with Earth Matters, the show that brings you coverage of environmental issues. I'm Donna Stevens, and I'm here today with my two co-hosts, Kim McCreary and Allison Civic.
Well, I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank everyone out there that actually called, okay, to the Fish and called the Fish and Wildlife Service and helped to stop the killing of the alpha female of the Fox Mountain Wolf Pack, because your voices really were heard. So I want to say, yes, you do make a difference when you speak out, and that's one thing I want to say to everyone and thank all of you for doing. In addition to that, I wanted to let you know that, as many of you may already know, especially around town, that we released a comprehensive newsletter with in-depth analysis of wolves in the West. So if you haven't picked up your copy, you can look around, because I know there are some more newsletters in town. We are also investigating the lack of law enforcement regarding illegal wolf shootings in the Gila. And we are starting to develop a plan to improve the situation. So we will keep you posted in 2013, because I'm sure we're going to need folks to take action again. Well, in addition to that, I'm happy to say we now have our newsletters distributed in Catron County. We've got businesses both in Glenwood and in Reserve that are taking our newsletters. And we've got 2 NM Wild signs that mark a stretch of the highway for our litter pickup brigade. So any of you that want to join the litter pickup brigade, again, just give me a holler at my email, kim@nmwild.org, because we certainly could use volunteers. Because we do want to keep the Gila nice and free from litter. And I guess the last thing I was going to say here about that is we have plans underway to work with the interagency field team, and these are the very folks that work in the Wolf Heartland. So that's something that we're working on now that we will go public on in 2013.
Well, Kim, the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance has really done a terrific job and a very creative job at integrating the arts with wilderness protection. Maybe you could tell our folks about the couple of projects that you did this year with the arts, like with Marina Zirkow and her wolf project and others.
Sure, great. Thanks, Allison, for asking that, because I get really jazzed when I'm talking about this. One of the things we did was, with blending the arts and science, is we sponsored an artist in residency for the International Symposium on Electronic Art. And before I go on, I want to thank Michael Berman wholeheartedly for organizing this. It was absolutely fantastic. And Marina Zirkow was the artist in residency, and she came here to Silver City for two and a half weeks, and she really had a crash course between Michael Berman taking her out and I took Marina out. We had a wonderful time, and the end result was that Marina and her collaborator Christy Lease, they created a suite of artwork having to do with Mexican wolves, cattle, and people. And what I really found so interesting about the work that they produced is that it actually evokes laughter, thought, and it depolarizes the all-too-heated rhetoric. So I would encourage anyone who really wants to see this work to visit our website, nmwild.org, and you can actually go and listen to see beautiful artwork where they have wonderful sounds to try and scare wolves away. But I think it was a very refreshing approach. And I think it also appealed to a broader spectrum of people, you know, bringing people in the arts together with people in science, and to me that's just like the perfect combination. So anyway, that was one. And another one that I don't want to forget, and this certainly was the doing of Denise Foster, and she is a staff member of NMWA's and an incredible organizer here, and she organized something called Wild Harmonies, and that was a solo concert given by internationally renowned pianist Hélène Grémont, and this was at the Lenzig Theater in Santa Fe, and all the proceeds went to wolf recovery projects. And we had 600 folks show up, And she did her solo performance, and I was fortunate enough to be in that audience. I can't even convey to you in words how moved I was and the passion she showed in her performance. You had 600 people standing on their feet howling with joy at the end of it. So it actually was just, it was just a wonderful event. And honestly, it's something that I really won't forget. So that's another example.
Yeah. So on the Wolf Front, what's in store for 2013 for wolf conservation issues?
Well, okay. So I'm going to ask folks to stay tuned for 2013, but I'll give you a bit of a rundown right now. First of all, we've got a surprise volunteer project in the works in the Gila Wolf Country. Because it's going to be a surprise, I'm not going to tell anyone any more about it yet. And also, I haven't finalized it, so I have to confess, right? I guess I'm not supposed to say that. But anyway, it is in the making, and I hope a lot of folks will look forward to that. So please, please stay tuned. In 2012, we also teamed up with the Gila Backcountry Services and offered our first eco tour in Wolf Country in the Gila Wilderness. And we'll be doing it again in 2013. And I do want to say that our trip leader is none other than Dave Parsons. And you just couldn't have a finer trip leader. Dave actually led the Mexican Wolf Reintroduction Project for Fish and Wildlife Services in the 90s. And during the last trip, there was a pack of wolves. One person, Zach Crockett, who runs Gila Backcountry Services, actually saw a wolf. And they actually heard wolves. So it is possible, and it did happen, and we sure hope it'll happen next year again. The last thing I wanted to bring up is that we are now taking reservations for our Yellowstone winter wildlife trip in February. And we will be taking folks to view wolves in the Lamar Valley in Yellowstone, and I'm sure many of our listeners have heard about the Lamar Valley. It is the place to be to see wolves in the winter. And we'll also be able to see elk, bighorn, sheep, sheep, bison, otters, coyotes, raptors, and you get to soak in the hot springs. So for more info, you can visit our website again, nmwild.org. And if you'd like to sign up for the trip, please contact Denise at nmwild.org, or you can call Denise Foster at 505-216-9719.
I want to go.
Yeah, so do I.
I'll be there so we can all go together.
Well, it sounds like you guys have been up to some really good projects this year, some really creative and kind of out-of-the-box type of projects going on. I wanted to ask you, Kim, what else is on the horizon in 2013 with NM Wild? I know you have a lot of things going on other than wolves. What are some of your other wilderness projects that you're working on now?
Well, we've got two really hot items right now, and that's the Organ Mounds Desert Peaks National Monument proposal, as well as the Rio Grande del Norte National Monument proposal. These are really important proposals, and I will say that they would together protect about 900,000 acres of wild places in the Land of Enchantment. So we are working on that, and I specifically would like to talk about the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument proposal first. We were really lucky this year here in Silver City because we had Las Cruces City Councilor Gil Sorg came up and gave a presentation about the monument to the Southwest County Commission Alliance. It was a great presentation. He also came here to the studio here at the Gila Members Community Radio. I was able to interview him for Earth Matters. Lucas Herndon, the executive director of Friends of Oregon Mountains and Desert Peaks, also was on the show. And, you know, they talked a lot about the monument to try to dispel a lot of the myths, because there are a lot of myths surrounding what this monument will and won't do. For example, there's been concern raised about border security issues. And in fact, Border Patrol, present-day Border Patrol, supports the monument. And there's a wilderness study area in the monument that will be moved about 5 miles north of the border, just so they will for sure be able to have access within the monument if need be. So it certainly isn't going to hurt border security at all. As a matter of fact, again, they really support the monument. So if you've heard otherwise, that is not the case. There also are concerns about whether grazing will be allowed or that folks can ride their
mountain bikes?
Mountain bikes, that's it. People will be able to use their mountain bikes. Existing roads will remain. Grazing will be allowed. So in essence, no land is being shut off. What it really is happening here is the land is being opened up so future generations will have it. And so I did want to let you know about that.
I understand, Kim, that there's been some endorsements by the counties and some of the municipalities in that area. Can you tell our listeners, first of all, where this monument is located, and then what municipalities and counties have supported or are endorsing this monument?
Well, the proposed monument is in Doña Ana County. And much of the monument surrounds Las Cruces, and some of it extends to the border with Mexico. It includes the Oregon Mountains, the Potrillo Mountains, specifically the volcanic field, as well as the Sierra de las Uvas Mountains, the Robledo Mountains, and also some really beautiful Chihuahuan desert grasslands. There is a broad support for this monument. We have Las Cruces, Sunland Park, Doña Ana County, the town of Mesilla, and El Paso all support the monument. Over 180 businesses support this monument, not to mention a multitude of conservation, hunting, and civic groups, as well as historians and archaeologists. So the support is absolutely rock solid.
And they're supporting this because evidence is pretty clear about the economic benefits of public lands, and it seems like this could be a huge tourist draw to this region. What are the benefits of making this area a national monument?
Well, there have been many studies now that have shown that the existence of national monuments by cities such as Las Cruces and the outlying towns and cities. They do economically benefit. It attracts, because of the quality of life issues, it attracts businesses, it attracts entrepreneurs. And so it creates jobs. It helps to diversify the economy. And so there are a lot of direct and indirect benefits that Las Cruces will gain from this, as well as El Paso, as you can see. I mean, they support the monument, as I said before. So there's some really solid evidence, which is why you have such a broad range of support.
Thank you, Kim. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us, please. Welcome back to the show, Earth Matters. I'm Donna Stevens, the director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm here today with Allison Civic and Kim McCreary. They've both given some of their summaries of what they've been working on in 2012 and the kinds of issues that are confronting us these days. And now it's my turn. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of some of the projects that the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, or UGWA, has been working on in 2012. We've been working on a couple of watershed studies, and these are in conjunction with the New Mexico Environment Department, because there's a couple of streams in our area that are in the Environment Department considers to be impaired for different reasons. So these are streams that are difficult to get to for the Environment Department because they're in wilderness areas, which of course means no motorized access. So one of these is Mogollon Creek, which is a tributary of the Gila River. And Mogollon Creek has too much aluminum in it. So excess aluminum can be bad for aquatic life, macroinvertebrates, fish, and there are some endangered fish in Mogollon Creek, such as Gila trout. And so we're trying to figure out where is this aluminum coming from? And if we can figure out what the source of it is, what can we do about it? So this project involves collecting water samples from Mogollon Creek at three different flow regimes or three different times of the year. So we're collecting water during base flow, which is kind of your average flow that, if you can say such a thing as average with our flashy rivers around here, kind of the average flow of how much water is usually in the creek. We're also collecting water during spring runoff when there could be more water than usual, depending on whether or not we've had any snow that winter. And also looking at collecting water during the monsoon season. So all of those water collections have been done now, and we're comparing the results we've gotten. We send the water samples to a lab. They test it for aluminum. We're looking at five different tributaries that come into Mogollon Creek. And then it seems like the excess aluminum is coming from one of these tributaries. And next, the next thing that we need to do is to go out there to this tributary of Mogollon Creek and try and figure out where the aluminum is coming from. And if we can determine what that source is, then come up with some plans of how this could be mitigated so that we can keep that aluminum out of Mogollon Creek. So that's one of the things that we're looking at. I mean, we are a watershed protection group, so that's our job, to protect our watershed, which is the Gila. And we're working on another project as well that is similar, and that one is in Black Canyon Creek in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness. So in Black Canyon, it actually flows from the Continental Divide up in the Black Range, and it flows down into the East Fork of the Gila River. So it actually goes through two wilderness areas, starting in Aldo Leopold, and then down into the Gila Wilderness once it gets closer to the East Fork. But our projects are all in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness, and so what we've done is, back in May of 2012, we installed data loggers in Black Canyon Creek. And these are recorders that essentially record the temperature of the creek every hour. So we have all these data now of what the temperatures were from May of 2012 and continuing right now, actually. They're recording even as we speak. So we went back in October to download the data just to make sure that we were on track and everything was working properly, and it was. And luckily, we were able to find all of our data loggers again, which was no mean feat, actually, because these things are very tiny, and you can be standing next to them and not even see them. But we had good GPS data and photos, so we found all of them. They were all still there. There weren't any huge floods that washed them out, and they're busily doing their job. And so the reason that we're concerned about the temperature in Black Canyon Creek is because it is too warm to support a thriving population of the threatened Gila trout. And there are some there, but not as many as there could be. It's actually really good habitat for them. And so we're trying to figure out, why is the temperature too warm? And of course, one of the main reasons it could be too warm is there isn't enough shade over the creek. So by having these data loggers in different segments of the creek, we can figure out where the temperature is good enough to support Gila trout, and where it's too warm and that those aren't the kind of conditions that they thrive in. So that's what we're working on there in Black Canyon. We've also done we did a restoration project in 2012 that involved protecting the Gila River from motorized access. So unfortunately, in the last few decades, people have thought that driving through the Gila River was good, clean, fun, and entertainment. And maybe we're spoil sports, but we happen to think it's a poor idea to drive in our streams. We have so little water in this arid part of the state, that surface water. And so we want to protect what we have. And so several years ago, the Forest Service placed these huge kind of car-sized boulders around the perimeter of the Mogollon Box Campground out on Box Canyon Road. And the intent was to keep vehicles from driving into the Gila River. Well, it was good as far as it went, but unfortunately they kind of ran out of budget money before they could finish the project. So they kept most of the cars and trucks and ATVs out of the Gila River, but not all of them. And also some of the huge boulders that they placed there were undercut by Mogollon Creek, when there were big floods, and they fell in and they weren't acting as a barrier any longer. So we received a grant, and the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance received a grant, and we went out towards the beginning of 2012 and got all of those huge boulders that had fallen into the creek and placed them back where they would act as a barrier again. And we also had delivered many truckloads of huge boulders that were perhaps slightly smaller than car-sized, maybe more like refrigerator-sized. Now these form a complete boulder barrier so that people cannot drive into the river anymore. They still have plenty of access because people can walk through these boulders and walk down to the river, and it's protected.
Donna, explain to us why we don't really want motorized vehicles in these areas. I mean, what's so damaging about ATVs and other vehicles driving through the river? I mean, is it a water quality issue, or what's the environmental benefit of keeping motorized vehicles out of this area?
Sure, I can talk about that a little bit. So it is partly a water quality issue because, as we know, vehicles leak fluids. There's motor oil, there's gas, there's all kinds of fluids in vehicles, and especially when you're driving through a kind of rocky, bouldery area, they can hit things, and fluids flow out, and they flow into the river, and so in that sense, it is a water quality issue. There's also some real kind of biological and ecological issues. Vehicles are heavy. They compact the soil, and they tend to fill in the little spaces in between the rocks and the cobble and the boulders. And all those spaces are home to little aquatic creatures that you would never even notice unless you really sit down and pay attention for a while. And these animals, these macroinvertebrates that use these spaces as breeding areas, or as home, as cover, all of these animals are at the bottom of the food chain. These are the kinds of critters that feed fish, and then, you know, it keeps going up the food chain. Birds eat fish, etc. It keeps going on and on. So we really need to protect these areas for wildlife habitat. And as well, when vehicles are driving through our riparian areas, they're also crushing and destroying native plant habitat. And plant habitat is very important for food for wildlife and for cover and nesting sites. So there's a whole host of environmental issues with driving through water. And I mean, there's so many roads already. People have plenty of places to drive. There's really no good reason for anyone to drive in the river. So when we did this project at the Muggy Ombox Campground, together with another project that we finished in, I think, 2011 on another tributary of the Gila, we protected about an 8-mile stretch of the Gila River from motorized access. So those are a couple of the projects that we've worked on this year.
Donna, thanks for UGWA's hard work on these issues.
Oh, you're welcome. Some of these projects actually are perhaps more gratifying than some of the work that you do, Allison, because some of these have immediate results. You can see people are no longer driving
right
in the river.
Absolutely.
And so it's not like copper regulations and things like that go on for decades.
Well, I would also like to thank both of you and your organizations for everything that you do for our community. We are really grateful.
Thanks.
Thank
Same to you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
So another project that we've worked on is an invasive plant inventory in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Area. This is an ongoing project. It isn't finished yet. This inventory is taking place over 3 growing seasons. So we started in the summer of 2011, worked on it again this year, and we'll finish up at the end of summer or into fall in 2013.
Well, Donna, do you have any preliminary findings that you can talk about?
Yes. So we're not finished yet. So yes, these are definitely preliminary. So what we've done is we've walked trails and riparian areas in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Area and looked at what kind of invasive plants are out there. And I'm glad to say that as of our preliminary results, they're looking pretty good out there, actually.
Great news.
So it is, yes,
that's
nice to have good news for a change.
No tamarisk up there, or very little?
We've seen some tamarisk, but not too much. Some of the plants that we've seen are kind of the things that are everywhere, like mullein, horehound, dandelions, Siberian elms. I mean, the plants that are just everywhere, to the point where a lot of people don't even realize that these plants aren't native to the south, to southwest New Mexico, because they're just, they're everywhere. And it would be difficult to get rid of some of these plants. But the reason that we're doing this, these inventories, is so that the Forest Service even has an idea of what's out there, because they don't have a comprehensive survey of what non-native plants are in the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Area. I mean, these places are remote. You can't drive to them, again, because it's wilderness. And it's very time-consuming, but for us, it's been great to do this work. I mean, you get to be out in these really beautiful places, and what we have found so far is that once you get about a mile or so from the trailhead, the incidence of these invasive plants really decreases dramatically. Why? I mean, people carry in plants on our weed seeds on our shoes, and also, horses are really good distributors of invasive seeds. And the farther you get from a trailhead, the more remote area you're in, the fewer invasive plants you see. So that's been very gratifying work, actually. So those are some of the kind of discrete projects we've been working on, things that have a definite end in mind, where we don't have to go on studying them forever. So I wanted to kind of wrap up the show here and thank you, both of you, for being on the show today, and wish everybody happy holidays, whichever holidays you choose to celebrate here at the end of 2012, and wish everybody a very happy and prosperous new year. We'll be continuing some of these issues on our next show. I'll have guests, our co-hosts, back here again, Allison Civic, Kim McCrary, and we'll be talking about some issues that will be continuing over from 2012 into 2013, and looking ahead to the new year to see what kinds of new issues we'll be working on. So happy holidays, everyone, and we hope to have you with us on our next show.